Will in-betweeners 10 be set on their deathbed?
Answer me this, answer me this.
Before Judge Dredd, was he Barrister Dredd?
Answer me this, answer me this. Helen and Ollie, answer me this.
Well, we start this episode with a timely question from Lauren in Bethnal Green, who says, Helen, answer me this. As an adult, have you ever been on holiday with your parents?
Whoa.
And I happen to know that this has an incredible amount of relevance to your current life.
That's right. Last week, I went on my first full Zaltzman family holiday since 1988.
Now, you use the word full, but you were there for how long?
I was there for one night.
One night. That's all you could manage with your parents.
I don't want to overdo things. It was a bit different to the holiday in 88. I no longer suck my thumb. My brother doesn't listen to nearly as much Bon Jovi on cassette anymore. And Debbie Gibson is no longer his second favourite musical artist. The last time we were in South Africa, this time we're in Hampshire, where there were no herds of warthogs, there were no rhinos, there were no lions killing giraffes. There were some cows. But another remarkable event that happened on the holiday is that for the second time in my life, I saw my dad wear jeans.
Wow.
Yes. It was a bit of a shock because he's usually cords only.
Yeah.
Occasionally, like, thick cotton trousers. But he said, I needed a pair of trousers to keep molten metal off my legs. That's why hipsters wear jeans, isn't it?
And when it comes to deciding what the itinerary is, I know that there's only one night and one day involved here, but you're someone who really likes to do what you like to do.
Yeah, I sacrificed that.
I can imagine.
I just got rid of that.
What did you do?
We went to a place called, I think it's called Buckler's Hard, and it's a place of maritime historical importance because that's where many of Lord Admiral Nelson's ships were built.
Buckler's Hard?
Yes.
I think I've seen a film about that on the internet and it wasn't maritime.
I have a real mental block on maritime history. I just don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
And you know, some subjects you just can't make yourself care
about. Absolutely.
It's one of those mortifying places that you and I, Ollie, find difficult where people are dressed in mob caps going, forsooth, I am Lady Harriet.
And yet, for some reason, I'm okay with Disney. I don't know what that is. I'm okay for someone to be a giant mouse, but if they pretend to have been born just 40 years before they were, I have a real issue with that.
Well, this one, there was quite a young guy doing a walking tour, and he was like, I am Henry Adams, the main shipwright, and who was alive in, I think, the 18th century.
Yes.
And he was like, this is my house where I lived until I died at 93. And the children on the tour were like, well, if you're dead, how come you're here? But how come you're not a ghost?
Yeah.
Etc.
It's like, a straightforward question.
It got quite existential with this guy. You know, who was he?
How did he answer it?
He hedged, but in a way that suggested that he knew that his job was inherently ridiculous, because he also pointed at the woman wearing the mob cap up the field, saying, there, of course, my daughter Mary, a woman at least 40 years older than him.
Oh, wow,
so
that's
then,
great.
Then he said, well, I've been bathing in the river here, keeps my skin young, ho, ho, ho.
So as experiments went then, sounds reasonable, 3 out of 5 perhaps. Would you go away with your family again, perhaps this time next year for, I don't know,
48
2 nights?
Hours? Yeah, I totally would.
Glad to hear it. I've been numerous times away with my family.
Yeah, you go almost annually, don't
we
you?
We were, until very recently we went away annually. And I think probably looking back on it, the best out of all of those, or at least the one that would most fit itself into the structure of a contemporary sitcom, would be when I was about 17, we had, as in myself...
You're not an adult when you're 17.
Well, it's borderline, isn't it?
No, you're not an adult.
Well, we had, as in my mother, my father and myself, had a family holiday booked in to go to the Garden Route in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
2 months before we left, my grandfather, my mother's father, died. And so to help my bereaving grandmother get over it all...
Bereaving? That's a new word.
Thank you. Yeah, I was happy with it.
Okay.
And we all know what it means.
Bereaved is really what you meant.
That would work too, yeah.
It would work better.
Yeah, all right.
Bereaving suggests you killed your grandfather to make other people bereaved.
Yeah. What's pedantry called in the past tense?
Same. Yeah. It's not a verb.
Shut up! They invited her along on the family holiday, but they didn't want to spend more money, so I ended up sharing a room with my recently bereaved grandmother. And I, like I say...
Who was that worse for, her or you?
Well, this is it. You know, there I was,
Randy, 17-year-old,
hormonally charged,
bereaved
looking
woman
to get drunk, skulking off with my CD player and a stack of Ben Folds. Meanwhile, my grandmother bursting into tears frequently, questioning the value of her own life and everything, literally everything, reminding her of her marriage.
But
sharing
a bit of booze and Ben Folds might have been a balm to her soul at that point.
Well, I think we did kind of help each other in a strange sort of way. We had I think definitely a more harmonious relationship, weirdly, than had my mother been sharing with her mother.
We have been on holiday with Martin's parents as adults, and because I hadn't been on holiday with my own family at that point for 20 years, I found going on holiday with another family very unsettling, especially as Martin Stadwell speedos.
It's lovely to be reminded how good my dad looks in a pair of speedos.
He is a short sleeve shirt.
Yeah, comfortable.
When you're on holiday with your family.
I'm not going to talk about my dad's penis.
I wasn't asking you to talk about his penis. Okay, maybe his general pelvic area.
I'm saving that for another podcast.
The podcast where finally we give you Freudian therapy.
Well, here's a question about the things we inherit from our families.
Carriage clocks.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to some really choice paintings. Seriously, they've got the fruit bowl thing.
The fruit bowl thing?
You know, the classic fruit bowl, I mean, that you do in art college.
Yeah.
Why do you have that on your wall?
So that you can be reminded what fruit looks like.
I guess so, yeah.
If you haven't got any in.
I guess so. Phil says, I have been blessed in many ways. I'm 6'3", I'm athletic, and I'm not awful looking.
Congratulations, Phil.
Blessed.
Are you single?
I have 20/20 vision,
right,
and a clean bill of health, and I've been born into a good family.
It's like a Jane Austen novel from the other side, isn't it? I have a fortune of $3,000 a year.
I imagine that's what Match.com would have been like in the 19th century. Recently, on the podcast, he says, you talked about balding. And that is where I have lost the genetic lottery.
What's wrong with balding? A man's scalp is a marvellous, shiny thing.
I'm 22, continues Phil.
Oh, okay, that's
unfair. Yeah, that is bad, yeah. Mm. I am definitely losing my hair at a decent rate.
You could be in my family.
Give it 5 years and I will be a full-on skinhead. As he's 6'3", fewer people will notice because he's taller.
Yeah, and also Phil, having been so blessed, probably has a magnificent skull and he'll get to show it off more.
Absolutely. So, Helen, answer me this. How did you win or lose the genetic lottery?
I don't know if that's for me to decide, is it? So much as the people that have to put up with me.
I think win, lose or draw would have been fairer parameters on this one. I think both of us have quite a few draws.
Yes.
And in fairness, probably not that many wins, but I wouldn't know if I'd classify that many losses on myself.
Okay.
You know, I'm happy enough. I can imagine that there are features that I would prefer,
yes,
but I wouldn't consider them a loss not to have them. You make do, don't you? You compromise, use your brain.
Yeah, and you did inherit your mum's genetics, which are very fine visually.
Yeah, if only big tits was useful to me. As yet, they've been a burden.
I think you haven't capitalised upon them yet, because you're too modest about that glorious rap.
What would you say, Helen? I suppose he's asking your favourite traits that you've inherited.
I've got a big head.
Yes.
I quite like that.
Yeah.
I suppose I have strong facial bone structure. Mm. That's nice to know.
We've
that
both
that's
got
under
that.
There.
Yeah.
I do have a massive forehead, though, and I have quite crap hair.
I don't think you've got a massive forehead or crap hair.
Thank you, Martin.
Sort of your role to say that, but well done for chipping in and saying it.
Well, I mean, you've got a massive forehead, but if you didn't have a massive forehead, it'd be out of proportion with your massive face. But proportionally, it's not a big forehead.
That's adorable of you. I wish I was taller, because both my parents are pretty short.
Do you wish you were a baller? Hey, yeah! Come on!
I set that up for you. Don't celebrate.
Oh, fuck. We high-fived and we missed. Hold on. 1, 2, 3.
I wish you could see this, listeners. That was tragic. Martin nearly fell off his chair.
Terrifying not to look at the mic stands.
Appalling.
I wish I had more elegant limbs.
Yeah, that was the next line that's Kilo sang, of course.
I worry that I have inherited too much of my dad's personality because he's a real pain in the ass.
Oh, yeah, but he's got a good sense of humour there.
Yes, I have the family GSOH.
Take that sourness and make it funny.
Now, what might be a win is that the family tend to live for a really long time.
Mm.
Like, 80s, pretty safe bet. My dad's mother lived till 99. Downside, Parkinson's also runs in the family, so that's like a lot of decades potentially with a debilitating and incurable condition.
Well, incurable now, but of course by the time you get to 80, it might be a different scenario, mightn't it?
No one's going to want to spend that cure on me.
Then you'll have the last laugh. I got psoriasis.
Oh.
Not a big win, but at the moment, thankfully, confined to my scalp. But yeah, it's elsewhere on my father, and he didn't get it elsewhere. He says until he married my mother, ho-ho, because obviously it's famously stress-related. But actually, you know, he was in his mid-30s when he married my mother, so whether it's stress-related or age-related, I don't know yet.
It's just waiting for you.
I could, in 2 years' time, suddenly start getting on my elbows and things, so that's not so good.
Okay, but it could be worse, because that is something you can cover with ointments or shirts.
Yeah, but you can't cure it. A bit like the Parkinson's thing. I suppose rather psoriasis than Parkinson's, so I win in the genetic lottery between us.
If you're choosing
a glass half empty guy.
If you're choosing one of the P's,
yes,
you go psoriasis.
I absolutely would. And I think out of the three of us, it's fair to say Martin's probably won more of the genetic lottery. You know, you're basically a good-looking man, Martin. I think people would be happy with most of your features.
You've got glorious head of hair.
Yeah. It's
magnificent.
My head of hair is my grandfather's, I think. And
he scalped him when he died.
Not literally. I think having hair on every other part of my body is from my dad, but
you're hairier than your dad.
I can,
because I've seen him in speedo, so I know.
This is true.
You're hairier than him.
I can grow a good beard though.
Yep.
And that's not all men can do that. I'm not showing off. That's just trans.
I think, despite the fact that certainly, I'm not going to say something dirty here, but certainly waist up, I think you've won the genetic lottery. I look at my legs.
You what, mate?
I think I've got shapelier legs than you have.
You've got lovely legs,
look,
Ollie.
You see, look at the tone. My calf, I think, is more shapely than Martin's.
Look at my sharp shins. I've got a bone here that you could cut fresh meat with.
You both have lovely shapely legs. I'm going to say Ollie's are more in proportion with his height.
Yeah.
Whereas Martin has the shapely legs of a 5'6" man.
Look at
the
my beautiful
body...
slender feet.
I'm not saying you have bad legs. I'm saying you've got average legs. What I'm saying is I've got good legs,
I've
I think.
Got lovely
legs. You've got a better top half. I've acknowledged as much.
Tell you what. I'll take pictures of your legs side by side, okay? And the listeners can decide who's got the better legs.
Lovely.
Yeah, come on, listeners.
I'm seeing this trending. Facebook.com/answer me this.
If you've got a question, then email your question to answermethispodcast@googlemail.com. 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 Answermethispodcast@googlemail.com.
Here's a question from Richard from Bath, who says, "Today, rather than stay in and watch more of the Commonwealth Games, I decided to go on a casual 20-mile hike through the Cotswold Hills."
As you do.
Watching the Commonwealth Games just makes me want to eat more cake. I've absolutely no desire to then go out and compete on any kind of level.
Oh, what are they doing? Swimming? Maybe I'll go and drink chocolate milkshakes in the bath.
Anyway, Richard continues. "During the walk through the Cotswold Hills, I made sure I was constantly checking my trusty OS map of the area."
That's Ordnance Survey.
That's Ordnance Survey, yes. Mm-hmm. For those of you who thought that OS always meant operating system.
Or old Sinokians from my old school.
That's
I get the OS newsletter once a year.
I'm sure there's literally a couple of people listening who thought it might mean that.
Yes.
It made me wonder, continues Richard, about how these maps are made. I don't know when the first OS map was published. Do you feel the question coming on? I suspect I do.
Can't see where it's going.
Can't see where this is going to come from.
Something about hiking blisters.
But I imagine, continues Richard, they didn't have aerial photography at the time. And these maps are remarkably accurate, showing even the smallest stream and copse of trees. So, Helen, answer me this. When was the first OS map published, and how are they so accurate? Did they send a man with an altimeter and a notebook over every square mile of Britain, or do they have more sophisticated methods?
No, it's pretty much that.
Yeah, I can imagine.
At the time, because they were making these in the 18th and 19th century.
Wow.
You're right, they did not have aerial photography then. And even when they were making the A to Z, I read a very good book about the making of the A to Z called Mrs. P's Journey by Sarah Hartley, if you're interested. She walked tens of thousands of streets in London and then did all these calculations to make sure all the angles were accurate. So even though London was smaller when Mrs. P was making the A to Z, mapping was bloody hard work. And this, it was absolutely grueling, apparently. Men walked hundreds of miles in a really short time to draw up these things.
And actually, this is going to sound like a very naive question, but really, how important was it to mark down the altitude of every hill?
You probably could have got away with it if you were a few metres out.
Well, this is it. I mean, couldn't you just indicate it's a hill? I mean, actually, is it that... I understand nerdishly, especially from the point of view of these kind of anoraki men, it's important to catalogue everything. But actually, how important is it for the user to have that level of detail?
Ollie, on Ordnance Survey maps, remember, they've got the little thin lines denoting gradient. So when they're really close together, it's a steep gradient.
Yeah.
If you're committing to that level of mapping,
then be precise.
It's not a job to be half-assed, is it?
But there's a really important application, actually. So a friend of mine went on this course on night navigation. So if you're like someone who's into like climbing mountains, especially places like Scotland, which are always wet, often stormy, you can very easily find yourself at night, or the night's drawn in, you haven't got home, or fog comes in, you can't see where you're going. So you have to navigate by the slope, and you want to get in. You don't want to get yourself in a position where you're about to walk off a cliff, basically, if there's zero visibility.
It's extraordinary, isn't it, that people still do that for fun? Like, I get that people did it before Google Maps
and before Netflix, but now there is Netflix.
But now, I go for walks. I like going for walks, but if I get lost, it's amazing to use my smartphone and realise, oh, I'm here.
But you can't do that in the middle of a Scottish mountain, I don't think.
The reception's a bit iffy.
But people go orienteering, don't they, for fun?
Oh, my God.
That's the reason people do it, is they like using maps. They go on trials in cars as well, because they like using maps.
It's because people other than you like using their brains, Ollie.
I can't imagine it.
The thing I dislike about OS maps is, firstly, at school we were forced to learn all of the symbols, even though we never ended up ever using an OS map. Secondly, impossible to fold.
Yes, once unfolded,
never folded
it's
again.
It's not going back in.
Which, when you're in a high wind outside, it's not that great.
They're available online as well. They have a whole, like, copyright.
Okay, but they weren't when they first came about, which is Richard's question.
Right.
The reason why they decided they needed maps of this detail was after the Jacobite Rebellion in Scotland of 1745, and so they wanted the military to understand the terrain so that that couldn't happen again. It was very strategic. And they were also worried... and so then a guy called William Roy, an engineer, was charged with doing this survey, but he died before it was finished. So I don't think there was really an OS map until 1801, when the first one-inch scale map of Kent was published.
Why Kent?
I think because it was vulnerable to invasion from France, and the French Revolution was in full swing then, and they thought that it might get across the English Channel, and they had to really up the defences.
I personally, however precise the mapping, am someone who does not enjoy navigation in any of its forms.
Are you really someone who comprehends maps?
You've probably got a small hippocampus.
I think the problem is, I am dyspraxic, I think. I'm so mal-coordinated and I have no sense of direction.
And distances, like the length of things, seems to fox you as well.
Basically, if
it's
any
all
of...
coming out today, isn't it? Things that Ollie can't do.
If any of my... Yeah, but shapely legs to do them with.
Let's let the listeners decide about that.
You also have long, elegant fingers.
Basically, if any of my carers or guardians had Hansel and Gretel style left me abandoned in a forest, I would die there. There's no option for me to find even a house with a weird pedo in it. Yeah. I'd just die.
And you'd eat the trail.
Yeah.
Martin has taken up monitoring the local bat population.
Someone had to.
No, they didn't.
No, actually, that's true. No one had to.
Because there are bats in Crystal Palace Park, which is exciting.
Yeah.
In London Park, to have bats, very thrilling.
They're really nice, actually.
Sure. Martin knows this because he's been eavesdropping upon them. He has bought bat monitors.
So my understanding of this, Martin, is you've got this... It's essentially a microphone. Of course, if you were going to have a hobby, it would involve pointing a mic at something.
Or is it more like an yes. amp?
Well, it's technically a heterodyne bat detector.
In English?
It's not to say microphone with a beat frequency.
It translates bat noise into understandable by human ear noise, correct?
Da-da-da-da-da-da-da, bat noise!
Yeah.
And you point your microphone with a stupid name at them. And then, this is very clever, right? The science then takes the tone that they're speaking to each other in and lowers it so the human ear can hear
it. That's a good... description,
which I get, and is an amazing tool and very cool and everything.
Yeah.
Once you've done that, once you've heard the bat talking,
you still don't speak bat, remember?
What do you do then?
Well,
do you just think, oh wow, I've heard a bat?
Well, I'm quite interested in what sort of psychoacoustic effects it could have by recording them in stereo. So as they fly past, obviously you can hear the signal as it goes past. There's Doppler shift and there's a sort of left to right pattern. So I'm interested in seeing whether you can recreate the bat experience in the privacy of your own home.
Right.
No, you can't recreate the bat experience in our own home, Martin.
Well, I've yet to discover that.
But with what? Recreate it with your music, for example.
He's going to start sleeping on the ceiling.
Ladies and gentlemen, may we present to you the intermission. Today, brought to you by Answer Me This, episode 95. Available to buy at answermethisstore.com. Stephen in Dublin says, I recently started yoga.
Good heavens.
Yeah. Following nagging. He's implying female nagging, I think.
I think nagging is pretty much always female.
It is. It's pretty much, isn't it? To try it, you might like it.
Yeah, but you're not going to try everything that people are going to say that, because they're going to say that about heroin, aren't they? And
yeah, but that depends who you're mixing with.
Having a dildo in your ear.
No one's ever said that to me.
Ollie, I've got this dildo. Do you want to put it in your ear?
All right, then. Oh, shit, you got me. You totally got me.
I brain dildoed you. Ah.
I am such an idiot. I have been brain dildo.
Dildo brain.
Give me those sweet, sexy questions, listeners, and give them to me in your own voice using our phone number, which is
0208 123 5877.
Or you can Skype Answer Me This. Ollie will still get off on that.
But to a lesser degree.
This is Andy Simpson from Stirlingshire. Helen and Ollie, answer me this. If the human body was regarded as a prime source of meat, what would be the best cut?
I haven't eaten human meat, but I'm going to guess that, as with other animals, you want a decent amount of fat so that the meat's flavoursome and not tough. So I'm going to guess that maybe the buttocks.
Yeah.
You've got the gluteus maximus muscle, you have a decent layer of fat. It's rump.
The animal that most often cannibals compare human meat to is pig.
Chicken. Yes, although William Seabrook, who wrote a book called Jungle Ways about his experiences in Africa in the 1920s, said that it tastes like no other meat he's ever eaten except veal, but stringier.
That guy was really weird.
Yeah.
Because like he never went to prison for being a cannibal.
I think he was just, it was fine as long as you're a rich white man.
Yeah.
You couldn't get into trouble for
like
anything.
Like an intrepid travel journalist. You know, like the equivalent of Bear Grylls or something.
Wait, under what circumstances?
He went to a lab where there was a dead person and asked, convinced the medical student or the authorities if he could taste a bit.
Was his attitude that, well, I'm in Africa, so they all eat corpses here?
Kind of, yeah. Mm. Like, let's explore the world, let's do something a bit different.
So he's a racist as well as a psychopath.
Well, it was just the style of the time.
Although, we do, as it, now we have that testimony, I suppose, you know, it means something, doesn't it? It tastes a bit like veal. I wonder if what the meat tastes like actually depends what we've been eating.
Because animal cultivation methods have changed. Well, factory farmed things indeed won't taste the same as non-factory farmed human.
Exactly. And people buy corn-fed chicken, milk-fed veal, don't they? And actually,
yeah, free-range things with muscles.
Right. So with humans as well, like the racial stereotype apparently that Japanese people say about us is that we smell of dairy. You know, we say racistly about French people, they smell of garlic. But there's some truth in it, isn't there? That certain things, if you eat them, are going to come out in the taste of your flesh.
Okay.
And I wonder whether, actually, therefore, it depends which human you're eating and what they've been eating as to which the tastiest bit would be.
Armin Muse, the German cannibal, said that it was like pork, but more bitter. And again, stringy. So I wonder whether the problem is the way you cook it as well. Maybe human meat doesn't respond well to slow stewing. Maybe you have to sear it or something.
Well, consensus seems to be pork. If the consensus is pork, then surely the best meat would be the same as on a pig.
Okay, so belly.
So belly.
Sausage,
that's what I was gonna say.
As well.
So exactly. And actually, if
human
you look
sausage
back to the serial killers who have Sweeney Todd style served up human meat for public consumption as a way of disposing of the bodies.
Were they good cooks, though? Armin Muse sounded like a pretty good cook. He had it with Brussels sprouts and a special sauce and stuff. Some of them, they're not going to cook it with any kind of regard for excellence of flavour and texture.
Would you need to hang it for a while?
Well, I was wondering that as well. I think cheek might be good. So I reckon there you've got the layering of fat and muscle. And it's not going to be tough muscle like thigh muscle probably would, or calf.
Yeah.
I get squeamish enough eating animal heads, I think I'd struggle with that. Tongue would be nice though.
Well, on the subject of food, here's a question from Michael, who says, I've recently heard that strawberries kept in a fridge with milk will make the milk go off. I've also heard that this is a common belief, not just made up on the spot. I can't find anything either backing this notion up or debunking it, and it might depend on if the milk's in an airtight plastic bottle, but Helen, answer me this. Do strawberries make milk go off? And if so, why?
This is like being the village shaman or something.
I think it's not a ridiculous question at all.
Really?
I think even if Helen is about to disprove, you know, the fact that it exists and that it is a myth, I think it's exactly in line with the kind of things you hear about fruit and veg that is entirely true.
Well, like bananas making other things ripen quicker because they release, ethylene?
Did you see that Supermarket Secrets thing?
No.
I'm not normally into this kind of BBC One primetime factual entertainment type show, but there was one with Greg Wallace that was on this week that was all about how supermarkets preserve their food, which actually I am really into. They said if you've got an unripened apricot, put it in a bag with a banana and the apricot will ripen.
Some of them you can put in a bag on their own and the ethylene gas will get trapped in there and they'll ripen anyway.
Yeah, Martin, now what's a myth? Now what's stupid?
Here's a crazy thing I read as well. If you put unripe fruits like mangoes into a bin of rice, that will help them ripen a lot quicker. Now, I know that you're supposed to put a wet mobile phone into rice to make it
dry out.
Didn't know that about mangoes.
No.
Probably similar principle, though, a gas trap of some sort. But regarding this strawberry thing, I tried many different combinations of words in Google, could not find anything about it at all. Mm. And just off the top of my head, I can't think of any reason why this would be the case, because strawberries are not that gassy or powerful.
They'd have to release such a potent gas that only affected the milk and didn't kill everything else in your fridge. The idea was quite like if you put something in rice is absorbent of water. If you surround something in rice, it's going to absorb water. That kind of makes sense to me. But the idea that strawberries have got this pungent anti-milk agent is nuts.
And milk is in a bottle. And also, how would you know that it was definitely the strawberries, not the other things in your fridge?
Have you done a randomised control trial?
Get back to us on that, Michael.
I sing like an angel, that's what everyone tells me. But for some reason, record labels won't sell me. They say my songs are so crap, they can virtually smell me. What on earth do they mean?
Instead, use Squarespace to build a musical empire. You can stream and sell your songs and merch through which to inspire other people to try their hand singing as you are so dire.
What do you mean, mate? I'm the new Jesse J. Mandem, mandem.
Massive thanks to Squarespace for supplying this show with their patronage, and thereby your ears with our voices.
And because Squarespace support independent podcasts, if you want to support independent podcasts indirectly, but your own website directly, go to squarespace.com, have a play around with all of their easy drag-and-drop web-building tools, and if you like them, after your two-week free trial, you can get 10% off Squarespace for a whole year if you use the code ANSWER.
And if you get bored with your website at any point, not a big deal, you can rejig it with a simple crack of the whip. Yep. Simple shake of the hand.
Wait, not a literal whip crack. Right.
It's only a matter of time before they innovate on that, Helen. Their templates are very clever as it is. Here's a question from Nick. A timely question about this season of weddings.
Yeah, although apparently more weddings happen in November than July.
Is that true?
Yeah, it's probably cheaper.
That's a great statistic if that's true. That's like my strawberry statistic. I love it. Greg Wallace could base a whole show around that. He says, Helen, answer me this. Has there been any research into bouquet throwing at weddings? And how reliable is the outcome in terms of predicting the next marriage?
Can't answer the second because I don't think there has been the first, because this would require very long-term research over a great number of people to be at all scientifically accurate.
Yes.
And I don't think it's important enough that most people could stand spending their entire adult lives working on this issue.
Well, may I say, as someone who works in news radio, that the motivation behind interesting statistics is not necessarily that people want them. It's usually to promote a product.
Yeah.
If there was an easy way for a company, for example, Moss Bros or something.
Match.com.
Yeah, it'd be a flower company, probably, wouldn't
exactly,
it?
Exactly. That could get this statistic, then they would. And in fact, it's not a bad idea, is it? If I work for Match.com, that's a good call. You could call up a wedding organizer company and say, can we speak to your clients, and just ask them how many of you caught the bouquet before you got married. Okay. And then you could have a bullshit statistic. It would get reported. I think it's not a bad idea to do the survey.
I think there are a lot of problems though, because a lot of people who get married may never have been in a situation where a bouquet is being thrown. I gather that it's more unusual nowadays because it's acutely embarrassing and no single women really want to be part of it. And also because people get married after much longer engagements and relationships. If you haven't met the guy yet, you might be a decade of actually sealing the bouquet deal. So there are a lot of problems, right? And bouquets are so heavy, you could knock one of the women out with it.
I would like to see a You've Been Framed style montage of that happening.
Yeah, I actually would. Yeah.
Particularly if it's an old woman being hit on the head.
This is a really easy study to do. All you do is you pick a hashtag, and then when someone catches the bouquet, you get someone to tweet their name. And you collect that information, and then you just do like a periodic scan through the register of marriages, and then you just start to build up the statistics. It's really
Martin,
easy.
We're alive. This is alive. I'm not going to spend years doing that. I've got things to do.
We're not getting any younger.
I've got TV to watch.
I'm less surprised that this research doesn't exist than I am that there hasn't been a major Hollywood romantic comedy in the style of 27 Dresses where someone does this research themselves as a single woman going around weddings being like, oh, it's a load of rubbish, and then ends up marrying the last man she expected to.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
A statistician.
A match made in stats,
a
heaven.
A cynical statistician.
Well, he's not cynical, but she is, because that seems modern.
She's a cynical New York journalist, isn't she? Yeah. Who smokes at the beginning of the film and has a gay friend.
She doesn't smoke.
Yes, she
does. She does drink too much.
She drinks a little bit too
much. And she has one-night stands, so you can tell that she's off.
Yeah. And he's like, well, statistically, you caught the bouquet, so we're going to get married in 3 years.
And she's like, yeah, no fear, mate.
You should write the dialogue.
I might, actually. Good, yeah, okay.
Who to play the lady?
Well,
Kate Hudson?
If you could get Emma Stone, that would be great, but she's probably too big. You'd probably have to settle for
Holly Hunter.
No, not Holly Hunter.
It's always Holly Hunter.
She's
with
nearly
you.
60, Martin. This is more of an Angelou role.
Oh, I know who could do it. Andy Serkis. He does everything.
I reckon Anna.
Doesn't matter if he doesn't look the part. You just do it with those stupid pins on his nose. It all later in post.
Anna Kendrick would be great because she can do romantic, she can do cynical.
Okay.
She's cute as a button.
Who is the statistician?
You want a younger Mark Ruffalo type. Or Paul Rudd.
Who would be good and his career's in the right place? Yeah. John Oliver. John Oliver is the statistician.
No, he's too sassy. He'd be like the cynical brother of the guy or something.
Yeah, but they'd look the same. You want a John Oliver type.
But I've never been at a wedding in my real life where anyone has jostled to catch the bouquet.
Now, as far as I recall, you didn't do this tradition at your wedding.
I didn't have a bouquet.
Yeah. Now, lots of the sort of, we've talked about this before, lots of the wedding traditions you didn't do, some of which because you're feminist, some of which because actually you just don't like them.
Yeah. They're bullshit.
Fine. But actually, what's your view on other people doing it? Because I do feel, even in the modern world, when you think it's a load of bullshit, it is just a bit of fun, isn't it? I mean, most people are doing it as a bit of fun.
Apparently, it used to be considered good luck for the bride to kiss a chimney sweep on her wedding day.
Wow.
In Britain, I did do that. And I gave him a blowy for extra good luck.
But what do you think of the idea of throwing the bouquet? Like, well, do you stand at the sidelines and sneer? Or do you think actually this is quite fun, even though it's embarrassing?
I think it'd be more fun if everyone who is single there joined in, not just the women.
Yes, I agree with you.
I think it's degrading if it's just women, because it suggests that, you know, all women are just waiting to get married and men aren't bothered. I think having a bouquet is quite weird because most brides are wearing dresses and shoes that are difficult to move in, and you're taking your hands out of the equation. You've got a thing you have to wrangle.
It's undignified, yeah.
You always have to hand it to someone else if you want to do it with your hands.
You were talking to people, and, yeah.
Yeah, so I'd say maybe have something else, a knuckle duster. I don't know.
Before you were married,
did
you used to avoid this particular event?
Yeah, the only wedding I went to as a single woman, I hid.
Literally hid?
I hid. I literally hid.
Why? Because there wouldn't be pressure on you to catch the bouquet.
Well,
so you can stand there and just not make much of an effort.
Yeah, I'm bad at catching anyway, because I have poor spatial awareness.
Yeah.
But I think it's because I would have felt degraded by it. And I was only 20, so I did not want to be the next person to get married.
Yeah,
I would have felt it quite inappropriate to get married when I was only 1 year into my university education. I wanted to play the field a bit.
Wonder if, as with so many issues, our experiences on this are coloured by our fear of audience participation.
Absolutely.
It is that kind of event, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like your heart sinks when someone brings the bouquet out and you can't
rest until
it's done. Yeah.
Kate Middleton didn't throw her bouquet. Instead, it was placed at the tomb of the unknown warrior in Westminster Abbey.
I don't think he's going to get married.
Well, you never know with the royal family, do you? If he's eligible, I'm sure they'll find a way.
I reckon Prince Andrew would have a crack.
That would be a PR coup.
How many social networks are you on? Vevo, Friendster, Parkview, Porn, MySpace, Ping and Google Buzz. If you want to be our pal, go to this URL. Facebook.com/answermethis or Twitter.com/HelenAndOllie. But please don't follow us in real life.
Here's a question from Mark in Durham, who says, after a long day, I need some cack telly to decompress. While Storage Hunters ticks that box with flying colours,
oh, yes.
I can't help but get a teeny bit irked about the auctioneer and his customer banter. Ollie, answer me this. Why do auctioneers make weird noises really quickly when trying to sell lots? It's just weird. Seeming like, 420, I'm bid 420. Do I hear 440? 440, I'm bid.
Yes. With American auctioneers in particular, they keep repeating. So even when there's not a bid, like, $1 bid, now two, will you give me two, will you give me three, now three, will you give me three, blah, blah, blah.
And it's like rap.
It kind of is. So what it is actually is it's hypnotising the audience, even in the case of Storage Hunters.
Hurry, get your money out, pay more money.
Exactly. It's exactly that.
It's showmanship as well.
It's rhythmically implying to the congregated audience of potential buyers that the figures are going to continue going up, and that the figure that he's saying is next, because he says, I've got two, will you give me three, is going to be reached.
Yep.
And the technical term they actually have for this is bidding anxiety.
Yes.
That's what they're trying to instill in the audience, bidding anxiety. You must act quickly to get this incredible special offer. And if they just said, right, deal's at 250, anyone? No. All right, I'll give you
5 minutes to think about it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You lose some of the pressure then to stick your paddle in the air and join in.
Yeah. And may I say, I recently went to bingo in Crystal Palace above a restaurant, not a proper bingo hall.
Mm.
It's very slow. And I really did feel like it dissipated the tension. I wanted to gamble, damn it. I was there to win. I did win. I won £25 in Sainsbury's vouchers.
Congratulations.
Thanks. It was my first go at bingo. I was very proud of myself.
Well done. That's good work.
But, you know, 40-odd minutes of a man reading out numbers. That's, you really want him to go, 44, 31, two fat ladies, 88. You want that kind of speed.
Otherwise, you might as well have just gathered together to do a Sudoku.
Yeah, you know, or data yourself. Entry.
Yeah. Exactly. And also, of course, the quicker that the auctioneers talk, the more money the auction house makes, thereby more commission for them. So they're paying their own wages by getting through it as quickly as possible.
Yeah. Also, often they have a lot of lots to get through that afternoon, don't they? So they really need to hurry up.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. It's just trying to create a series of dramatic moments to hold the attention of the auctionees.
I'm surprised that eBay hasn't developed an equivalent that you can put on a soundtrack. Put it on your watch list, you're watching 8 items at the moment, one of the items is gone, you have missed that item, 1 minute left.
Is it stolen? It appears to be stolen. Yes, it definitely is stolen. Are you going to buy it anyway, even though it's stolen?
In the FAQ, they say this dress is 48 inches long from the shoulder and there is mild staining at the hips. This is not a genuine vintage garment, it is reproduction. Here is a question from Neil, in, but not from, Birmingham.
Oh, someone mentioned the Midlands, you get the obligatory auditory release.
Ollie, answer me this. Can I get Martin to say, oh. So he says, Ollie, answer me this.
Yeah.
How much is a brand new bus? Is it more than a fancy sports car? How much is a fancy sports car rather than a common or garden boring sports car?
I was going to say, but that's quite a difficult thing to define. Like a Porsche, I guess, is something like 100 grand, but then you can get, what's the really, really fast one that they only made like 100
of? Spider or something?
No, it begins with an M. I want to say Michelin, but obviously that's the...
Mondeo.
Porsche Mondeo, please.
What's it called? McLaren, the McLaren.
Yes.
McLaren F1, that's like $1 million or $2 million quid.
Okay.
So I don't know.
100 of those or something.
Let's take a median for a Porsche sports car at being somewhere between 50 and 100 grand. I think that's what most people think of as a sports car price.
Like a nice MG type.
Exactly.
How much do you reckon a bus is?
Open top or not? Because if we're comparing like for like, open top bus and sports car are the equivalent vehicles.
No, I would say like a modern Routemaster.
A double decker, like a London Red bus. Are we going for as the classic bus rather than a short bus?
I'm going to say 400k.
Well, I think that's probably about right, actually.
Yeah.
And the reason I don't have a definitive answer is you can buy buses direct from Arriva. You can buy buses direct from Volvo. They're new.
Don't Mercedes make some
of them
as well?
Mercedes make coaches, I think, more than buses. But yes, I'm sure they do. But they don't list prices on their website. You have to call and inquire. And I just wasn't prepared to pretend to be someone that wanted to buy a bus.
You mean you didn't put a freedom of information request into TfL?
Well, no. With the TfL issue, you raise an interesting point. So what we don't know is how much Arriva and Volvo and the like charge you to build you a new bus. But what we do know is what the government spent, what TfL spent, on the most recent Routemasters. The ballpark figure for 600 buses was around £180 million. That's right. Around 300 grand each.
Oh, okay.
So now that's 300 grand each for a purpose-built, specially designed for Boris Routemaster.
With new R&D to pay off.
But they did build 600 of them. So I reckon, therefore, that actually a one-off bus with no special design is going to be about 400 grand. Yeah, I reckon that's about right.
Mm.
Yeah.
I really wish that when they were selling off all the old Routemasters, I'd had the... It was something like 25 grand to buy one, because that...
Really?
...tucked in my parents' garden would be a lovely little bolt hole.
Well, yes, but you've got to still insure it. Interestingly, even if it's declared off-road...
Really?
..you've still got to insure it, because apparently people steal petrol from buses very regularly.
Okay, but if it's not got any petrol in it...
People smash in windows because they're vindictive and weird when they see a bus. Mm.
But also you've got to pay the conductor every time you get on.
Here on the left is ancient palace. Is palace, which is very old. Here on right is two dogs doing it. Oh, yes, they're having good time. Oh, yeah, go doggy. Oh, you like that doggy. Yeah, you still going. Oh, go doggy. Go. Now he finished. Okay, we move on.
Answer me this holiday. All the fun of travelling with none of the stinky toilets or frightening food. Out now at answermethispodcast.com/albums.
Here's a question from Sammy, who says, I'm a 29-year-old male mature student, and I will be attending either Goldsmiths University or the University of Birmingham in September, studying English literature and creative writing full time. So Helen, answer me this. What goes on at Freshers' Week?
What doesn't go on at Freshers' Week?
With your encyclopedic knowledge of exactly what goes on in 2014 at the University of Birmingham in September Freshers' Week.
Or Goldsmiths. I bought my first teapot in Freshers' Week. That's how I rolled. 11 years later, the spout fell off.
I would like to see, says Sammy, what it's all about, but I'm a little concerned. Like he's just going to stay in his room and not come out at all.
I'm afraid.
I'm a little concerned as to whether mature students really are that welcome at Freshers' Week. Are mature students seen as a bit weird? I'm going to say yes on this. I know it's not very sensitive, but yes. Or will I fit in? I do want to join a few societies like the Atheist Society and the Skeptic Society.
Oh, God.
Will I fit in okay there?
Yeah, because it'll all be full of misfits there.
Those are full of grumpy weirdos.
But you'll be probably pissed off at they're all 18-year-old idealists with really hardline politics, and you'll be more scarred by life.
This is all a bit daunting for me, says Sammy, as I've spent my work life from the age of 16 in the army, then behind a desk in a soul-sucking job.
Well, this might all seem a bit trivial to you then.
I actually remember specifically the kind of corporate takeover that was beginning to happen at Freshers Week when we started. The student pound was being courted by various different companies, so we went to like the Freshers Fair. I would say every alternate stall at the Freshers Fair was essentially some corporate thing trying to make you wear their brand or sign up to their graduate scheme or something.
Hey, here's an Accenture mug, now sell us your soul.
Yeah, there's a lot of that.
And a load of pointless crap, like I got a Jack Daniels branded wooden Tangram.
Well, that's what I was
going to say. What are Tangrams for anyway?
What's a Tangram?
I do remember also going to the Freshers' Fair and being heavily pressured by the Tiddlywinks Society to join, and I didn't.
Well, you have to put pressure on in Tiddlywinks, otherwise you get no progress on the board.
I just remember thinking I was going to have a really difficult time at university because I was very shy and I thought, oh, the first few weeks I'm going to really hate it.
And you did.
So I had this idea of if I wore the same suede jacket every day, like people would remember me because I'd be wearing the same suede jacket.
Yeah, that's your branding, Martin.
Wow.
It's such a stupid idea.
Visual iconography for
yourself. Yeah, really. Like, people won't forget me because they probably won't remember who I am. So if I wear the same
suede jacket guy.
Every day, yeah.
Actually, I am kind of like that when I start a new job. Like, I secretly, I would
you
never
don't
want...
change your pants or your smelly pants guy.
No, when I'm trying to remember people in the office and I can't remember anyone's names, I will write down in my file if I'll be like, Jewish-looking guy, Greg.
Yeah, that's what they do. That's what they do at the Apple Genius Bar.
Yeah, but the last thing you want is for those people to see that. Yeah, neurotic woman, Elaine.
Well, do you remember there was a guy with very strong visual branding at our college, Nick the Stick, because he used to walk around in like a green cape carrying a stick.
I'd forgotten about him until you just said that, but yes, I do.
On the other hand, though, often Freshers' Week is wild because it's many of these people's first taste of independence, living away from home, getting to make all their decisions for themselves. Maybe because Sammy's been in the army and then a soul-sucking job, it's kind of his first taste of proper liberty as well. I can't really imagine what it'd be like to have to consort with all these recent school leavers when you're in your late 20s.
Yes.
I think that'd be quite trying. So maybe, Sammy, the best tactic for you is to make friends with graduate students.
I was going to say, I think go to the graduate thing because there is always that sexual frisson there in any fresher event, I think, because there's that expectation that people have, rightly or wrongly, that university is partly about banging. And I think if you're there, they're going to look really, really young. It's one thing if you were 22, 23 and they were 18, then you might feel like you had the pick of the spread. If you go at this age, you're going to feel like a paedophile.
Well, Sammy, just for you, I asked my friend Ben, who, like you, went to university in his late 20s, what Freshers Week was like. And he said, people talked up the age difference problem to me and what a nightmare I was in for, but making friends with people who are younger than me was not a problem at all. Actually, it struck me how easy and effortless people are at that age. Lots of energy, lots of chatter. I found the only person who had a problem with my age was me.
Oh, that was almost like a Springer's final thought, the way he delivered that.
That's how wise Ben is.
Wisdom comes with age.
I tried to be as open-minded as possible and went to as many interesting-sounding events right across the university. Don't get me wrong, it was definitely challenging recalibrating and changing expectations of self at times, but that's really what you've signed up for anyway.
God, that's such a mature student way to put it, isn't it? Recalibrating expectations.
I think he also worked a lot harder because he actually wanted to go rather than just going automatically straight after school like
lots of people. Yeah, I kind of wish I'd been a mature student, really. Because I'd go now and, like, I'd rule.
Well, now you'd be paying through the nose for it as well,
yes,
whereas we had it on
really
Easy
want
Street.
To be there.
So I hope that's confidence inspiring for you, Sammy. Ben does have an extremely youthful face. I don't know whether you're blessed with one of those. He looks about 17 now and he's 36.
Well, if like Ben, you were a mature student and have some experience to share with Sammy, send it to us. All of our contact details, as ever, are on our website,
answermethispodcast.com.
And you should also use those contact details to send us a question. And remains for us to say thank you, Square Space, for sponsoring this episode of Answer Me This.
And thank you, for listening to it.
Congratulations for that life choice.
Bye!
You love podcasts. The stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.